Hello, good day. First of all, I'd like to thank Professor Liu and Dr. Hout, where is he, for inviting me and for everybody here for attending. I apologize to the translator who I think is up there. There we go. I didn't realize I should have given you a copy beforehand, but I promise I'll try and talk slowly and clearly. Yeah? All right. Okay, so my topic is mainly about understanding the spread of the gendarmerie model over into Latin America. As Professor Luca just mentioned, this is not a case of simply copying and pasting. There's actually, it's quite a complex process and not one simply about a technical transfer of policing knowledge. In fact, I would note that there's two elements to this spread, one that is practical, one that is ideological, and they both go hand in hand. In terms of the practical, in the Latin American case, as it was across Europe, the spread or the attractiveness of adopting a new policing models or new ways of organizing the state was born out of social economic instability of the 19th century, as we had seen across Europe in particular, with this conquest and then retreat of Napoleonic armies. We have, again, a great sort of, despite all the efforts to, as we say in English, put Humpty Dumpty back together again, it proves impossible to put the old political order back on its feet. And as such, what we see is the adoption of what they seem to work. That is, the French seem to be very successful at mobilizing their people behind the state and using that to national goals. So as thus, despite, let's say, a great, distaste for revolutionary France and Napoleonic France in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, we find that the French models of policing spread across Europe. But again, there's always the ideological element. So, for example, the Guardia Civil in Spain or the Carabinieri in Italy, which are clearly based on the French Gendarmerie, are sort of presented as sort of national institutions. That is, there is acknowledgement of the Gendarmerie, but there's always this attempt to sort of balance this by saying that this actually comes from our national heritage, to sort of give greater legitimacy to it. And or, in the English case, just to simply call them new police. That is, of course it's not French, it's English, it's new police. So this type of ideological element also comes into Latin America. Now again, I'm dealing with post-imperial Latin America, so in a sense sort of following on, or actually sort of parallel and then following on from what the other paper had talked about. Now, the 19th century was one of, how could we say, sort of perhaps great frustration for Latin American elites after independence. That is, this is a period of fairly constant instability, which in itself brings out this sort of tradition for what they call corriaje, which is sort of like warlordism, for lack of a better word. So by the time we come to the end of the 19th century, basically these sort of political and national questions have still not been resolved. What is to be Latin American? How much do we embrace a Hispanic heritage? How much are we something different? As well as the sort of deep social cleavages that have their political manifestations. So by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, the sort of there is a sort of a frustration. And then on top of this, we have, of course, social economic change, just like there is in Europe. We have greater movement into cities. So the old rural order is being disrupted, either because of the fact of the growth of cities, or in the case of perhaps many Central American countries, the sort of switch of the economy to sort of export of a main cash crop. So this produces all sorts of, like I said, sort of social, economic, and political problems. And it is this that many Latin American countries sort of embark on this idea of now trying to construct a sort of more modern, more unified, and often this means more centralized state. So in this sense, not much different than what happens in France, not much different that happens in Spain, not much different that happens in Italy. Now, while throughout most of the 19th century, the countries that Latin America, and again, sort of being the fact that these are, you know, now independent countries from Spain, as always is the case when a country becomes independent, the first reaction is to reject all that seems to be related to the former colonial power. And this is no different in Latin America. There is a great perception that a lot of the ills, a lot of the problems in Latin American society come from the fact of its Spanish heritage. So as such, for most of the 19th century, both in policing as well as in military matters, many Latin American countries looked to France to help them reform their military and their police. In certain senses, this is perfectly logical. On the one sense, France is seen as modern and most of the time, or at least half the time, Republican, but also as well, importantly, it's seen as Latin. So in this sense, they will understand the Latin American situation better than, say, the Anglo-Saxons would. Though that being said, there is some reaching out to the United States, but as we'll mention in a minute, that's quite complicated. So for the most part, like I said, there was a look towards France throughout this period and a rejection of, again, their sort of Hispanic or a distancing. And with justification, because basically throughout the 19th century, Spain had still been attempting to recoup its losses, that is, to sort of recover lost influence, if not outright reintegration of former colonies back into the Spanish Empire. So it's quite understandable why many Latin American countries, despite the fact that, as mentioned, the Spanish Empire had, at least on the continent, had collapsed in the Americas, but still had a military presence in the Western Hemisphere in the form of Cuba and Puerto Rico, a limited intervention in Santo Domingo, or what we now call the Dominican Republic, so on and so forth. Basically, what changes, as I mentioned before, there's by the time we get to the 19th century, there's a sort of rethinking. Again, with all these problems, the expected advantages of adopting a sort of liberal model, that is one that's sort of very similar to the Republican model in the United States, isn't really working, or it doesn't seem to be working. On top of that, the United States is flexing its muscles, so to speak, ever more greatly by the end of the century. Indeed, since the beginning of the century, in 1823, of course, the United States had announced the Monroe Doctrine, and in which case the United States had taken upon itself unilaterally to protect the Western Hemisphere from Europeans, though it did not at that time have the strength to do so. By the end of the 19th century, they do, and what we see is again increasing military involvement in Latin American affairs by the United States. Indeed, Spain itself had experienced this in the 1898 war, where it was driven out of its last colonies in the Americas, as well as in the Philippines and Guam, by the United States. So this was not something that was necessarily welcomed by many Latin Americans, particularly so as the sort of Americans, at least in this case, seem to be showing their true face. That is, for example, take what happened in Cuba. The United States says, we are disinterested in any political involvement in Cuba. We're just trying to do the right thing and get the Spanish out. And they had passed what was called the Teller Amendment. The Teller Amendment, in which case they said, we are just going to do that and we have no imperial pretensions in Cuba. Lo and behold, shortly after the Spanish are driven out and the Cubans have, let's say, silly ideas about being independent, the Americans decide to change their policy and have a new amendment, in which case they say, well, if things go wrong in Cuba, we, you know, should step in and help them out because they're a young democracy and they need our tutelage, or at least that's the way it was sold. This was, of course, followed by the what's known as the Roosevelt, the Teddy Roosevelt, not obviously Franklin Roosevelt, the Teddy Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which basically set out that the U.S. has the right to be the policeman. That is the best way to keep the Europeans out, or this is the justification, the imperial Europeans out, is for the non-imperial United States to look after Latin American affairs. Yes, I know it sounds silly, but they honestly meant it. So, as you can imagine, at this period of time, we see increasing intervention, particularly in Central America, by the United States. And again, the very sort of wording of the Roosevelt corollary, which again, if Latin American states cannot control their own affairs, the United States has the right to step in. So you can imagine again how they take that. So what we see is what Professor Luke had mentioned, a sort of pushback to it. Now, some of this had already occurred in the 1890s before the actual Spanish-American War, which I'm going to posit as a watershed. And the first case, well, what we see, sorry to sort of step back one second, is a reevaluation, the sort of pushing of Spain out of the Western Hemisphere, and the sort of growing power of the United States had caused a reevaluation of the relationship between Latin American countries and its former colonial power, Spain. In fact, what we'll see is that by choosing their sort of more Latin or Hispanic heritage as a form of resistance against U.S. influence. If this will not work, is it not on? Where's the sensor? I think we took the sensor out when we were trying to. We can do it the manual way. So what we can see here from the map. Is in the list of the rights, what we can see is obviously a listing of Spanish Civil Guard missions that were sent to Latin America. And the point that I want to make is prior to this period, the amount of Spanish missions to Latin America was zero. So again, there is a sort of watershed here. Now, Latin American countries, again, are going through great instability. They need to, they feel the need to sort of reconstruct their states, to reform their police forces. And again, this idea that perhaps the problem of them sort of forming a sort of more coherent national polity is because of their rejection of their sort of Hispanic roots. There's this sort of concept here. So on the map, as you could see, there's different shades of green, which I'll come back to later. But the important point is to see, again, the amount of missions that are sent during this period of time. Let's see if this is going to work. No, it's not. Okay. The first mission actually occurred, again, in the 1890s. Gives a good example of why, the sort of complications, the political complications of these missions. And the first one was in Guatemala. The president, as we can see over there on the left, General Reina Barrios, had decided that he was going to send off a request to Spain. He was himself in an attempt of restructuring the state. This is always a given in all of these projects, to reconstruct the Guatemalan security forces and the state. He made a request to Spain in 1893 to send over two Civil Guard officers to help them reform their police. In 1894, two Civil Guards were sent. Now, we have to remember, again, in Central America, this is where the United States has its heaviest influence. Again, this is the growth of these sort of cash crops and export economies are being constructed. The Civil Guards had sort of gone over, the two gone over, and they'd started their work as hired. Then becomes a slight problem. Reina Barrios was assassinated in 1898, as seems to happen quite frequently in the region. After he's assassinated in 1898, he's replaced by one of his cabinet members, Manuel Cabrera Estrada, who decided to terminate the Spanish Civil Guard mission, and instead he contracted a U.S. police officer, Gustavo Joseph, he's from Washington, D.C. police officer, to help continue the work of the Civil Guards. It would be hard to imagine that this was an independently arrived at decision simply because of the fact that prior to the Spanish Civil Guard mission, the previous policing missions contracted by the Guatemalan government were of, well, American police officers. So you can get this idea that this is a squashing, in a sense, of this limited resistance by the Guatemalans to, let's say, increasing U.S. influence in their affairs. Indeed, throughout the region, the United Fruit Company becomes, again, really sort of flexes its muscles to what we now call in U.S. historiography the Banana Wars, where we become involved in various affairs of Latin America. So this one ended was this sort of first attempt at Spain to sort of reach out to its Latin American former colonies and build bridges was, you know, cut short, in this case, by a bullet. So, almost strangely, Guatemalan's neighbor El Salvador, who also reached out to Spain, has quite a different experience, though being no less under, let's say, the tutelage, if that's the polite word for it, of the United States. It's not going to work. I should just not be so optimistic. Right, so again, very similar social economic situation as in Guatemala. In this case, everything's pretty much a carbon copy, but again, as I mentioned, a quite different result. Now, in this case, arguably part of the reason is probably because of the stronger ties between El Salvadorian leaders and Spain. In fact, the president who had contracted the Spanish Civil Guard mission, Manuel Enrique Rajo, did so at the request of the general who was put in charge of figuring out how to reform the Salvadorian police, a fellow named General José María Peralta Lagos. Peralta Lagos actually did his military training in Spain, so it shouldn't be as a great surprise that he said, hey, while I was in Spain, I heard about this great institution called the Civil Guard. Let's call them over. Given the sort of great parallels between many, let's say, Central American countries, the idea of big, large landed estates, you can see why this is an attractive proposition because, of course, the Civil Guard are policing great landed estates across most of middle and southern Spain. So the model seems to fit. They had contracted the Spanish in 1912. They arrive in 1913, and unfortunately for President Araujo, he's assassinated. But this time, the Spanish are not sent home. Instead, his successor as president actually kept the mission on, who was headed by this captain of the Guard Civil here, Alfonso Martín Garrido. He's actually kept on. And in fact, when the mission concludes in 1916, they rehire him again and keep him on for another 3 years. Indeed, afterwards, by the 1920s, I mean, this was considered a great success, but by the 1920s, we see sort of working class mobilization in El Salvador. We see increasing sort of mobilization, and they call the Spanish back again in 1923 to have another mission. Indeed, this is reciprocated in the sense that after this second mission, which lasts from 1923 to 26, a group of National Guardsmen from El Salvador are sent to Spain in 1928 to study firsthand how the Spanish Civil Guard works in practice. Indeed, what we can see here is, in fact, all these next three presidents that follow Araujo and El Salvador, two of whom are brothers, and the other one is a brother-in-law to one of them, so there's a strong family connection. They all belong to the planter elite. So again, the Civil Guard model suits their own interests to have. So we can see, again, at the same moment, like I said, a sort of social economic, but also as well, this concept that while the U.S. is increasing its influence in El Salvador, their method of resistance, but also as well, they're seeing that sort of fits better what they believe with their society is to, again, embrace Spain, embrace their Hispanic heritage. Now, I'm short on time, so I'm going to move forward very quickly. The other, besides El Salvador, the other country that has, let's say, the strongest links with Spain is that of Peru. And most of this is done under the presidency of a fellow named Augusto B. Leguía, who's president twice. Now, Leguía was, again, a great believer in modernizing the nation state and modernizing society. Yeah, if we can move to the next slide, that'd be fantastic. And indeed, during his first presidency, he'd attempted to contract a rather ambitious project of 100 civil guards to come over to Peru, which you could imagine didn't pan out because of, well, the costs, and I can't imagine Spain had 100 civil guards to spare. But when Leguía comes back to power in 1919, he goes back to Spain and says, look, you've got to help me construct the new state. So in fact, as we can see here, Colonel Landazuri in Madrid, they're now sort of contracting out civil guards to come. And indeed, from about 1921 to about 1932, we see three consecutive Spanish civil guard missions to Peru, and they grow in strength each time. Now, again, I mean to sort of point that this is not just simply about technical stuff. There is, again, obviously an ideological element here. So, for example, in 1922, when they open the new police academy in Lima, the civil guard officer is there, and he decides, you know, that amidst cheers to Viva Peru and La Madre España, that is, Mother Spain, he says that, well, maybe adorning the entrance to the school, they should have the same motto, El Honor es su divisa, honor is my motto, is my... to which case, Leguía, the president, suggests we should tag along to that, as in the mother country. So we can see, again, this very strong sort of cultural element here. This is not just simply about technical knowledge, civil guards coming over, teaching them the latest European techniques in policing. If we can move to the next slide, you'll see how actually evident this is. So we can see here on the left the Spanish Civil Guard emblem that they wear on their lapels, and on the right that of the Peruvian Civil Guard. You might notice they're slightly similar. The main difference, obviously, being that the Spanish civil guard are adorned with a crown and the Peruvian with the Aztec sun god symbol. So basically the same. The uniform's the same. The name is the same. The motto is the same. The structure is the same. And again, it's something that continues on. Very much, again, aware of that this is a Hispanic project. Now, I don't want to, if we can move to the next slide. Now, I know it looks very impressive, all of these Spanish missions being sent to Latin America, and I want to sort of temper my argument somewhat, that is, moderate my argument somewhat, by noting that Latin American countries have not gone wholeheartedly over to Spain. In fact, if we look at some of these countries, like, for example, Colombia, first had gone to France to reform its police. Then it obviously had the Spanish mission from 1916 to 1920, after which was followed again by another French mission. They also had reached out to Argentina and Chile for police cooperation and technical advice as well. So what we see is, again, they're sort of back and forth, and a lot of these countries are sort of doing that. They're sort of tasting different waters, and particularly when we get to the 1920s, which, just like in Europe, is a very sort of difficult period of time for many Latin American countries. They look to countries like Spain, which at this point is under the sort of Catholic military dictatorship of General Primo de Rivera, but also, as we see, is obviously, of course, now under the control, Italy is under the control of Mussolini. So what do we see? Many Latin American countries sending their police officers or sending requests for information from countries like Spain and Italy for this exact reason. In the 1930s, to Germany. If you could spare me just 2 minutes, I would like to talk about the Spanish dimension to this, if we could sort of move to the next slide. Now, from the Spanish perspective, obviously, they're not simply sending this out because, oh, well, they've asked us, they paid us, we send the police to help them out. Of course, for Spain, this is seen as a bridge to its former colonies, of Spain being the sort of, you know, the great madre patria, the mother fatherland of this global Hispanic community. And we can see here that the Civil Guard are seen as sort of integral to maintaining that community. So to sort of translate, unfortunately, I can't pick this out. But as we can see in the, it says here, the ex-Ministerio de Ultramar, that would obviously be the ex-Ministry of Foreign Affairs, or that is not necessarily foreign affairs. It's overseas colonies, ex because, of course, now Spain does not have them. We see a statue of Colón. The caption says, Columbus says, to the Civil Guard, if only you had arrived sooner, we wouldn't have lost the colonies. That is, the problem was the weak Spanish state, not having a great Hispanic institution like the Civil Guard, as was mentioned in the previous paper, to keep everything together. And this was, again, the impression that the Civil Guard, as a Hispanic institution, helps keep stability in the Hispanic world. And this is something the Civil Guard, unsurprisingly, embrace. For they themselves are very heavily criticized throughout this period. They see this as a sense of legitimacy, as well as helping out what they would call hermanos de raza, roughly translated racial brothers in Latin America. So they see as helping out. But again, in their articles, they're always constantly talking about not just simply helping out in a technical sense, but being the spiritual guides that are reforming the emotional bonds between Spain and its former colonies. And this is how they see themselves. And this plays very much, again, into this Hispanic ideal, if we can move to the last one. In which case, looking at a poster by the military rebels, the Francoists during the Civil War, this concept of Spain taking, you know, having this global role as a spiritual leader, particularly in the Latin American world, we can see here, the translation being Spain, the spiritual compass of the world. So again, this is very much brought into the idea of Spain, its civil guards, and it's something that they try to tap into and build on throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s with Latin America, with somewhat success for the military dictators in Latin America who continue to look to Spain as a successful model of dealing with social problems. Unfortunately, one that usually involves shooting a lot of people. But, well, that's another paper. Thank you for your patience.